We're going to begin the first section of tonight's installment of Radio Free America 37 for all practical purposes, the end of this massive broadcast. We're going to hit, as I said, we're going to hit the ground running next week. Now, over the course of the past 3 months or so, specifically tonight is October 11th, and I began this program, this archive show, on July 26th. What we've been looking at is the way in which the Galen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, which was brought into the United States at the end of the Second World War and became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, and ultimately the NATO intelligence organization, and finally the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German, now German intelligence service. We have taken a look at how that organization basically functioned as a Trojan horse within the United States. We've taken a look at the Crusade for Freedom and how it resulted in the introduction of rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War into American society, how it paved the way for many of these Third Reich intelligence operatives, in particular people from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, how they were able to assume leadership positions in some of the ethnic voting blocks within the United States. And we've taken a look at how the Galen organization and its functioning in this regard was functioning as an extension, a literal extension of the Third Reich's national security establishment, and how that national security establishment basically had it planned well before the end of World War II to hook up with the Western powers and basically to use that alliance in order to regain Germany's lost territories. As we looked at on September 6th of this year, the map of Eastern Europe has been redrawn along very much the lines that the Ostministerium of Alfred Rosenberg and in the Third Reich basically would have liked. It has been redrawn along lines precisely corresponding very closely to those that the Ostministerium would have liked. The Cold War has basically worked to the benefit of Germany. Obviously, the Soviet Union is no more, and although we are still in existence, our economic situation has been badly compromised as a result of the Cold War, and as we'll be looking at this evening, our political system has been totally compromised as a result of the Cold War. Last week, we took a look at how both Reinhard Galen and Admiral Karl von Dönitz, who succeeded Adolf Hitler as the head of the Third Reich, how they had both planned to use the alliance between the United States, or between Germany, the resurrected Reich, and the Western powers to regain Germany's lost territories. This has happened, and we have also taken a look at the effects, to a certain extent anyway, the effects of the Cold War on the American economy. Now, I want to touch back on a concept that I introduced a number of weeks ago, specifically in the broadcast of August 23rd of this year. I talked about the dynamic of the tank versus the bulldozer. In order for capitalism to work properly, the capital has to be invested in such a way as to generate more capital. And dollars spent on government issue are not nearly as beneficial as dollars spent in the civilian sector. If we contrast, for example, the spending of capital or the investment of capital in tanks versus bulldozers, well, take a look at a tank for openers. Who pays for the tank? The taxpayer pays for it. It comes out of the taxpayer's pocket. The expenditure is out of the public sector. The same is true for the fuel, the ammunition, the spare parts, the pay for the people who drive the tank, the pay for the people who maintain it. All of that comes out of the public sector. All of that is basically added to the national debt. All of that is a drain and a burden upon the taxpayer. In turn, the tank itself simply goes on maneuvers, it burns up more fuel, it shoots ammunition, it uses up more capital, and it is basically that is not an efficient way of using capital. Although there is some capital generated with the initial outlay for the tank itself, fuel, etc., it is not nearly as productive a way of investing capital as the capital that would be invested in a bulldozer. If we take a look at a bulldozer, and by way of contrasting that with the tank, the bulldozer is, of course, paid for out of the private sector. It's fuel. It doesn't use ammunition, but it's fuel, the maintenance, the spare parts, the fuel, the salary of the driver and the people who maintain it, are all paid for out of the public sector. These things do not add to the national debt. They don't add to the deficit. They are not a burden on the taxpayer. And beyond that, and more importantly, the bulldozer itself builds factories, it builds shopping centers, it builds movie theaters, it builds things. Its activity is involved in building things, which in turn generate more capital because people are going to be employed in the factory or the shopping center or the movie theater. That in turn gives them discretionary income, which they're going to spend on goods and services of one kind or another. This is, of course, something of an oversimplification, but it is basically accurate. And as a result of the policies laid out in NSC 68, drawn up by Paul Nitze during the Truman administration, the stratagem of forcing the Soviet Union into bankruptcy, but with massive military spending as a result of that, and obviously that policy had its fulfillment in the Reagan and Bush years, the United States has been spending a tremendous amount of its resources on tanks versus bulldozers. And in addition to the enormous burden this has placed on the American economy as a result of forcing the taxpayers to shell out these enormous expenditures, it also has seriously drained our economy because an awful lot of our R&D brains have been sunk into things like electronic warfare systems or guided missiles or jet planes, avionics systems, nuclear submarines, guided missile submarines. And those things have a very limited usage. They are not productive ways of investing capital at all. This is one of the main reasons why the U.S., which had been the world's biggest creditor nation from the end of World War I all the way up through 1980, is now the world's biggest debtor nation, and it has had much to do with the altering of our economic situation in the Reagan and Bush years, or really in the post-World War II period. The U.S. is still the largest and therefore the most influential economy in the world, but our financial system is in terrible shape, and many financial experts have been predicting the failure of major commercial banks after the election. If their prognostications are true, the situation we are facing is truly frightening, and I am not in a position to predict precisely what effect that will have on the world's capital markets, but it doesn't figure to be good, and ultimately, if the American taxpayer winds up having to bail out the commercial banks, much as the American taxpayer has wound up having to bail out the savings and loan industry, our already strained financial system is going to get even more strained, and I think there's a very strong possibility of a total financial collapse in this country, perhaps as part of a world financial collapse. We'll touch on some of the political implications of that next week. One of the things that I think we can assume happened at some point, exactly when, I don't know. I don't know if anyone aside from the insiders knows. But at some point, the resurrected Reich that I have been looking at over the past month or so, and again, I want to stress that that will seem like an absolutely wacko concept to those who have not heard the other programs. That's why I have taken the time to lay out the documentation, not just on the development of the German national security establishment in the post-World War II period, but also the structure of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, the reinstitution of the Third Reich civil service, much of the Third Reich's political leadership, the judicial system, not to mention the reinstitution of the very same industrialists and financiers who had backed Hitler politically and helped to power his war machine. All of those were put right back into the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, and that consequently were in a position to take a look at the Galen organization as basically an extension of a resurrected Reich, as a projection of a resurrected Reich, or perhaps resurrected is the wrong word, of a survived Third Reich, just as we have relied heavily in this series on the book The Nazis Go Underground, a very important, though little known, anti-fascist work from 1944, written by a very prominent anti-fascist author named Kurt Rees, whose works unfortunately have been eclipsed in the Cold War period. The Third Reich had indeed planned to survive military defeat, and it's rather obvious that they did. At some point, it's a safe bet that this resurrected Reich, or this survived Third Reich, was able to project the long-term effects of the long-term economic effects of the Cold War on both the United States and the Soviet Union. Bear in mind now, we're not talking about a bunch of children or a bunch of neophytes. The Galen organization was an extremely powerful is, because it still survives in Germany, a very powerful, very sophisticated major intelligence service, which was staffed by Third Reich intelligence veterans, many of them SS and Gestapo officers. So this is an organization which would have been able to draw projections of the effects of the Cold War on the long-term effects of the Cold War on the U.S. economy. As we looked at last week, von Dönitz and Galen had foreseen an alliance of a Hitlerless Reich with the Western powers as a means of surviving military defeat in World War II. The Christian West concept, negotiated by German industrialists and financiers who were serving as diplomats / spies, their negotiations with Alan Dulles, which we're going to touch back on, concerning the Christian West concept, ultimately provided the seed concept for NATO. And at some point, again, I think we can assume that the effects of the Cold War on the U.S. as well as the Soviet economies could have been accurately forecast by the survived Reich. I'm going to reread, a short passage from a book called The New Germany and the Old Nazis that was authored by T.H. Tetens, T-E-T-E-N-S, a book we relied on heavily in this program. It was published in hardcover by Random House, copyrighted 1961. Of T.H. Tetens and his credentials, the back flap reads, T.H. Tetens, a leading expert on German geopolitics, was born in Berlin and worked during the 1920s in Germany as an economist and newspaper editor. For more than 30 years, he has studied the Pan-German movement, the Nazi Party, and the strategic theories of German geopolitics. When Hitler came to power, Mr. Tetens was put in a concentration camp. He escaped to Switzerland in 1934. There, in pamphlet and newspaper articles, he foretold the coming German assault on Europe. In 1938, Mr. Tetens came to the United States and began research on German problems for government agencies and private organizations. From 1946 to 47, he served with the U.S. War Crimes Commission in Washington. Mr. Tetens is the director of the Library on Germanic and Related International Problems. Of course, that is circa 1961. Now, of one of the many SS and Gestapo veterans who moved into the political leadership of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, Tetens writes of a Dr. Gustav A. Sonnenhol, S-O-N-N-E-N-H-O-L, and this individual, again, an SS veteran, as we shall see, became the head of the Information Office for Marshall Plan Aid in the Adenauer administration. And we're going to take a look at the policies he advocated, because I think in his statements and in his policy recommendations, we can see an indication of what must at some point have become a deliberate policy of the resurrected or survived Reich. Exactly when this became a policy, we can't say, but it is a safe bet that at some point it did. Tetens writes of Sonnenhol. Dr. Gustav A. Sonnenhol, who joined Hitler's brown shirts and the Nazi Party as early as 1930, had a similar career. Later, Dr. Sonnenhol became an SS officer attached to von Ribbentrop's diplomatic staff. According to the Frankfurter Rundschau, November 22, 1951, Dr. Sonnenhol boasted after the war that, quote, it had been an honor to have served as a member of Hitler's SS, unquote. This Nazi record was no hindrance to the old fighter who in 1950 was appointed head of the Information Office for Marshall Plan Aid in the Adenauer administration. A few years later, Dr. Sonnenhol became the senior advisor to Vice Chancellor Blücher in the second Adenauer cabinet. B-L-U-E-C-H-E-R is the spelling of that last name. While in this position, he wrote a memorandum in which he advocated that Germany exploit the Cold War to the utmost and make sure that no agreement should be reached between the United States and the Soviet bloc. Last sentence again. While in this position, he wrote a memorandum in which he advocated that Germany exploit the Cold War to the utmost and make sure that no agreement should be reached between the United States and the Soviet bloc. According to the Hamburger Echo of March 27, 1954, the Sonnenhol memorandum aroused much criticism in England. And again, I'm rereading this passage, which we've had in previous installments, because in the views of Dr. Sonnenhol, I think we can see a projection or a reflection of what at some point must have become a German policy. Again, Galen and von Dönitz, no doubt other members of the German General Staff, were looking to an alliance with the West as a means of regaining Germany's lost territories. And bear in mind, again, that the myth of denazification of Germany is exactly that. This is not to imply, again, that all Germans are Nazis. One of the chapters in T.H. Tetten's book is called The Other Germany. He indicates that there are many democratically minded Germans, and many of them have some influence, but he was not optimistic about the long-term prospects for them being able to prevail in the light of the renazification of the major institutions of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. And I would add that my view of the contemporary United States is precisely the view that Tetten's had of Germany in 1961. There is an other America, so to speak, but I am not optimistic about its prospects for political success, given the fundamental corruption of our institutions, in particular our national security establishment. But at some point, the policy of using, obviously the plan was established in the Third Reich before its military defeat, to use an alliance with the West to regain Germany's lost territories. Germany is reunified, and its considerable economic problems, and current economic problems notwithstanding, at some point figures to be the economic power that dominates Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. It is already the most powerful economic power in Europe and a major, major economic power on the world scene, and I think that is a situation that is likely to grow rather than diminish. But the effects of the Cold War on the United States, and in particular on the U.S. economy, I think at some point must have been projected by the national security establishment and probably the intelligence service, the Galen Organization in particular, and it, at some point, probably pretty early on, judging from Sonnenall's statement in 1951, that the Germany should see to it that the U.S. and the Soviet Union should never be able to achieve a rapprochement. At some point, the effects on the U.S. and Soviet economies of spending so much capital on tanks rather than bulldozers must have been projected and seen, I think, as a vehicle for assuring Germany's ultimate economic triumph. What we're going to be looking at this evening is the effect of the Cold War, and in particular, the effect of the victory, the limited victory achieved by the survived Reich and the Galen Organization, a Trojan horse inside of the United States. We're going to be taking a look at the effects of this on the United States. We've seen how it affected the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. We've seen how it affected Germany. Tonight we're going to take a look, and to a lesser extent next week, at the effects it has had on the United States, because the events that are being reported in the press, both printed and broadcast, from one day to the next, are direct reflections and manifestations of the events that have taken place since the end of the Second World War. What we're going to look at first in the examination of the effects of the Trojan horse, the Galen Organization, on the United States, we're going to touch briefly on an essay by Carl Oglesby in Covert Action Information Bulletin Number 35. Now, Covert Action Information Bulletin Number 35 is their issue from the fall of 1990. And there's an essay in this by Carl Oglesby, again, last name O-G-L-E-S-B-Y. It's called, the essay that is called Reinhard Galen, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. And in the very beginning of this essay, we find the following introduction by Carl Oglesby. William Scheirer closed his 1960 masterpiece, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, with the judgment that the Nazi regime, quote, had passed into history, unquote. But we cannot be so confident today. On the contrary, the evidence as of 1990 is that World War II did not end as Scheirer believed it did, that Nazism did not surrender unconditionally and disappear, that indeed it finessed a limited but crucial victory over the Allies, a victory no less significant for having been kept a secret from all but the few Americans who were directly involved. Last sentence again. On the contrary, the evidence as of 1990 is that World War II did not end, as Scheirer believed it did, that Nazism did not surrender unconditionally and disappear, that indeed it finessed a limited but crucial victory over the Allies, a victory no less significant for having been kept a secret from all but the few Americans who were directly involved. And Oglesby closes this essay with the following observations. The key point that comes crashing through the political and moral confusion about this matter, once one sees that Galen's organization was an arm of the Odessa, is that whether it was ethical or not, the U.S. did not pick up a gift horse in Galen at all. It picked up a Trojan horse. The unconditional surrender the Germans made to the Allied command at the Little Red Schoolhouse in Rouen was the surrender only of the German armed services. It was not the surrender of the hard SS corps of the Nazi Party. The SS did not surrender, unconditionally or otherwise, and thus Nazism itself did not surrender. The SS chose rather to seek other means of continuing the war, while the right wing of the United States military establishment, through fears and secret passions and a naivete of its own, chose to facilitate that choice. The history that we have lived through since then stands witness to the consequences. Indeed, it does. And again, the sentence, which is a key here, by Oglesby reiterating, the key point that comes crashing through the political and moral confusion about this matter, once one sees that Galen's organization was an arm of the Odessa, is that whether it was ethical or not, the U.S. did not pick up a gift horse in Galen at all. It picked up a Trojan horse. And that is what Carl Oglesby was writing about in the fall of 1990. By way of beginning the substantive part of our examination of the effects of the Cold War, the effects of the Galen Organization, the effects of this Trojan horse on the United States proper, we're going to listen to a section of Radio Free America program number 35. That program, or this particular part of that program, was done on January 15th, 1989, more than a year and a half before the Oglesby essay, which I just read parts of, came out. Again, that was from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35 from the fall of 1990. What we're going to hear now is a section from Radio Free America program number 35 entitled The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror and the Exoneration of the Secret Team. And specifically, we're going to hear a section from an article that an op-ed column that appeared in the Chronicle by James Michener. But before that, we're going to hear my prognostications concerning the U.S. having lost the Second World War. This, again, in January of 1989, long before the Soviet Union dissolved, which happened in August of 1991. And we're also going to hear about my use of the term Trojan horse to describe the Galen Organization a year and a half before Carl Oglesby used that same phrase. So now we're going to listen to a short section from Radio Free America 35 from January 15th, 1989.
Now, traditionally, when nations have gone to war, the armies are generally used in order to acquire wealth from their enemies. Most wars have been struggles over goodies. Sometimes they're religious wars, but in general, wars are struggles over markets. Basically, somebody wants somebody else's goodies, and they fight for it. The armies have traditionally in history, and this is obviously not a revelation, this is pretty common notion, have been used to gain control of an opponent's wealth. One of the significant aspects, I think, that has been overlooked by people as they examine the Galen spy organization and the Nazi rocket scientists, many of them war criminals and SS men brought into the United States at the end of World War II, is that basically we were incorporating the German military, which we had been fighting just a few months before. People have noted that, but they have failed to take note of what Christopher Simpson has taken note of in his new book, or recent book, Blowback. One of the points that Christopher Simpson makes in Blowback, and we're going to go into this in some detail in weeks to come, is that by channeling false intelligence to the United States concerning Soviet capabilities and Soviet intentions, the Galen Organization deliberately built up fear of the Soviet Union in the American citizenry and in the U.S. national security establishment. Eventually, the false intelligence being provided to the United States, that the Soviet Union was being portrayed by the Galen Organization as a huge, huge menace, whereas in fact, for all of its large standing army, the Soviet Union was badly damaged in World War II and did not represent an offensive threat to the United States, particularly not when the U.S. had the A-bomb and the Soviet Union didn't. The U.S. has always been well ahead of the Soviet Union in military power, and yet the Galen Organization was very successful not only in convincing the American national security establishment, but also American conservative politicians that, in fact, the Soviet threat was much, much greater than it was. the profound Galen influence on the Reagan administration through the aforementioned von Bolschwing von Dahm relationship should be borne in mind here. It should be noted that the United States, which was the world's greatest creditor nation in 1980, is now the world's biggest debtor nation in 1988 because of the extraordinary military buildup by the Reagan administration to combat this perceived menace. Ultimately, what has happened is, in order to defend itself against the Soviet Union, which is not the threat that the Galen Organization made it out to be, the U.S. is now bankrupted. And the strongest economic powers in the world, the two Axis nations, former Axis nations, I think former might be and should be placed in quotes here, Japan and Germany. I think from a practical standpoint, the Galen Organization can be viewed as something very similar to the old Trojan horse. During the Trojan Wars, the Greeks built a huge wooden horse. I'm sure you're all familiar with the story. They hid some soldiers inside and wheeled it up to the gates of Troy. The Trojans, viewing this as a gift from the gods and a sign of their impending victory, brought it inside and used it as the centerpiece in a celebration. Then, of course, the Greek soldiers came out and conquered Troy. In a very real way, the Galen Organization and the paperclip scientists, particularly the Galen Organization, have served as a Trojan horse for America. The United States literally wound up losing World War II. The gains that the German armies could not win on the battlefield were obtained when the German military was incorporated into the United States. And as a result of the bogus intelligence they have fed to the United States for the better part of a half a century, the U.S., in order to finance this crazy military buildup, is now bankrupt and is literally at this point, for all practical purposes, a German and Japanese colony. The United States now is totally in debt and is being supported. Our operations are being supported by the sale of high-interest treasury bills to the Japanese, the Germans, and to a lesser extent, the Arabs. A colony is where you use your investment capital and the other guy's natural resources and labor in order to develop finished goods for your markets at home and for their markets, the colony's markets. I think people should consider that to what extent the U.S. is now a German and Japanese colony. And again, I think as we see names like General Aniline and film cropping up, as we see some interesting connections between people like Arthur Lyman, companies like TCI, his law firm having incorporated TCI, von Bolschwing, the Galen Organization, the Reagan administration, consider the Galen Organization as a Trojan horse and consider to what extent that organization literally affected the military conquest of the United States, not by defeating American armies on the battlefield by force of arms, but by channeling and misleading the United States, both politically and militarily, about Soviet aims, thereby achieving German goals in World War II. And again, the Trojan horse metaphor, I think, is important. And remember Kissinger, his relationship with Fritz Kramer, who, if May Brussels hypothesis is correct, is an IG general. Okay? By way of contemplating the colonization of Germany, in as much as, again, for people who later hear this program on tape, in as much as it's now, it is today, January 15th of 1989, Martin Luther King's birthday, and in as much as this is the weekend that is set aside, tomorrow's a national holiday, to observe Dr. King's birthday, I think it might be worth contemplating not only a couple of aspects of the past presidential campaign, including the racist aspects of that presidential campaign, might also be worth contemplating just how far from Dr. King's dream the present American political reality is. At the end of the Mary McGrory column I read you at the beginning of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast, Mary McGrory makes an interesting observation. Somebody besides Gazelle and Walsh may have an interest in finding out the truth and applying the principles of justice. But to exhibit it is to risk being thought vindictive, unquote, or even worse, negative. The law is for the likes of Willie Horton, not for a Marine who said he would stand on his head in a corner if the president told him so. Willie Horton, of course, was a convicted black rapist whose parole or release from prison and subsequent crime became a cause célèbre for the Bush campaign and did a lot of damage to Michael Dukakis. The fact that it was not Michael Dukakis' furlough program which released Willie Horton got right on by the American people, as so many things have gotten by the American people. Contemplating the recent presidential campaign, I think a very important column appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 7th of 1988. This is an analysis of that campaign by James Michener, the well-known author. And this Michener column is, well, basically, there are two, there's a Jim Leach, a Republican, and James Michener, a Democrat. I'm not going to read you Jim Leach. But James Michener said the following concerning the recent presidential campaign, this from the San Francisco Chronicle. Michener's column is headed, "Campaign had ominous signs of American fascism." It should be noted here that James Michener, as we'll see, is no screaming liberal. In fact, he's a hard-nosed Cold Warrior, literally a Cold War liberal. But again, this column, "Campaign had ominous signs of American fascism" by James Michener, San Francisco Chronicle, Wednesday, December 7th of 1988. "This year's election scared me. It was conducted with a brutality and lack of attention to basic issues which appalled, and the success of its ugly strategies flashed signals that this was the kind of electioneering we should expect during the next three national campaigns of this century. What frightened me? The tactics that proved so effective were those which Joseph Goebbels found useful in destroying the German Republic in the 1930s. First, the big lie, the endless repetition until it becomes accepted truth, and the desire to destroy the opposition rather than refute its arguments. Second, appropriating the emotional symbols of nationhood, such as the flag, the Pledge of Allegiance, prayer in schools, exploitation, exaltation of the family, opposition to abortion, and a macho boast that all citizens have the right to carry firearms and use them at will. Third, denouncing anyone who did not pass those self-imposed litmus tests as outside the mainstream, unpatriotic, and perhaps even treasonous. Fourth, the callous use of race, in the case of Willie Horton, to inflame prejudices and divide the population. Michael Dukakis was not defeated, he was destroyed, and that kind of victory does not serve the Republic well. If persisted in, it could lead to American-style fascism. I am a liberal Democrat who unsuccessfully ran for Congress in 1962, one of the best things I've ever done, for it taught me facts about American political life. As a member of the board of directors of Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe, which strive to present an honest portrait of our nation abroad, I am an anti-communist warrior. Early in 1988, I realized that the Democrats probably could not win this year and recommended that they offer a ticket that was boldly liberal, that tried to further the agenda of Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson, and, if necessary, accept Jesse Jackson on the ticket as vice president in hopes of whipping up enthusiasm and determination to capture the presidency in 1992. Halfway through the Democratic National Convention, when enthusiasm was at its height, I wrote, quote, "The election is lost. The images coming out of the convention will terrify the South and alienate the Midwest, and Dukakis will be lucky if he can hold Bush's electoral vote to under 500, unquote. I was referring to the impression that Jesse Jackson was running the show and that the cameras were focusing only on black faces. This did not worry me, for I had already conceded this election and was looking forward to 1992, when an old-style coalition of liberals would have a chance at sweeping the country as Roosevelt had done 60 years earlier in 1932. I never remotely believed the poll figures showing Dukakis ahead by 17 points, and was not surprised when that lead vanished after the Republican National Convention, where George Bush presented himself and his program brilliantly. But I was not prepared for the supine way in which Dukakis allowed Bush to steal the limelight, establish the agenda, and paint Dukakis as a secret, dangerous liberal and Bush as the protector of all that was good in American life. I have the highest admiration for the tough, amoral men who engineered the Bush campaign. They realized what had to be done and how to best do it. Their adroit manipulation of the Pledge of Allegiance, a rubric invented by the editor of a Boys magazine to spur sales, was brilliant, as was the draping of gigantic flags about their candidate. Also, once they had Dukakis knocked down, they never allowed him to get off the floor. And the way they contrived to have Senator Dan Quayle confront the press in a rowdy public meeting in his own backyard, where the media could be made the enemy, was an act of genius. However, the Bush men did corrupt the political system, and, in a time of quiet and growing crisis, they prevented any reasonable debate on the great issues facing this nation. As a consequence, we have postponed rather than solved our problems, and when the due bills are presented, the results may be devastating. again resuming. As a consequence, we have postponed rather than solved our problems, and when the due bills are presented, the results may be devastating. What are these problems? Consider the enormous burden of debt whose management tempts us into so many false steps. The imbalance in our trade with foreign nations so that we became a consuming nation rather than a producing one. The abandonment of one major area of production after another to other nations better organized, trained, and disciplined than our own. I refer to steel, automobiles, communication systems, shipping, clothing, shoes, and even minor items like the printing of books. The constant selling off of our capital goods to foreigners at bargain basement prices. The debasement of our public schools so that we send half-educated young people to compete against fully educated Japanese, Germans, and Koreans. The determined swing of our judiciary to the hard right so that the natural changes that all societies need to survive will probably be inhibited as civil liberties are lost. We divert so much of our wealth to the servicing of our trillion-dollar debt that most of the taxes I pay go to service debt. We are making bankers richer and workers poorer, and I expect this imbalance to worsen. Because we have a consuming rather than a producing nation, my home is filled with Japanese products like televisions, sound systems, and, perhaps next time, a Japanese car. I am surrounded by products made in Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, Germany, and Spain, but few made in the United States. When I go on vacation, it's in foreign ships, Dutch, Norwegian, Italian, Greek, British, and never American. In Honolulu recently, I was shocked to find in the local papers 4-page color ads printed half in English, half in Japanese, for simultaneous distribution in Tokyo and Osaka, offering scores of fine Hawaiian homes for sale to Japanese businessmen, investments sure to increase in value, plus enticing messages to Honolulu residents. Quote, list your homes and condos with us, and we will sell them to Japanese buyers at great profit to you. In a significant part of my own profession, I work not for American publishers, but for the two big German houses, Octopus and Bertelsmann. The decline in American education shocks me, and I have heard the manager of an important company tell me, quote, I've given orders to personnel, hire no more graduates from blank college because they cannot read or write and understand directions. Colleges now use texts not as difficult as those I taught in high school half a century ago. But it is the prospect of seeing 4 or 5 ultra-right-wing justices on the Supreme Court that really scares me. For then, the subtle balances that have prevailed in our civic life may be destroyed. I think people should take note of the growing xenophobia in this country. The street-level fascists, such as the Nazi skinheads that are gaining increasing publicity and are increasingly violent and well-organized, as well as the Aryan Nations elements that we're about to take a look at, are able to correctly, to a certain extent, maintain that America is deliberately being handed to foreigners. Of course, they then cite the Jews and the blacks and other people, although these street Nazis, as I call them, your Nazi skinheads, your Aryan Nations types, they're not to be overlooked, by the way. They have strong connections to the national security establishment, as we looked at in Radio Free America shows 10 through 13. But although they cite Asians as a menace, they don't tend to act against Asians, at least not to the same extent that they do against blacks and Jews and Mexicans. I think it's worth noting, you know, for our purposes here, that the arguments presented by the skinheads, by the Nazi skinheads, I should say, because they're not all Nazis by any means, but not by Nazi skinheads, by the Aryan Nations, that the American working man is being left out in the cold, that the nation is being sold out to foreigners and, you know, racially inferior types, that will meet with a lot of sympathy at the street level because, in fact, a lot of people are out of work. The very factors that James Michener cited in his column are facts. So I think, although obviously the philosophy is corrupt and is to be opposed, its marketability under the current climate is not to be overlooked. And indeed, as we contemplate Dr. King's life and work, I think we may want to take note of just how far we've sunk from the ideals Dr. King expressed.
And that again from Radio Free America program number 35 from January 15th of 1989, which obviously is the holiday that is celebrated, the Dr. King birthday holiday, or that was in 1989. What we're going to be hearing in the rest of this section of Radio Free America 37 is the effects of the processes which I have been outlining during the past 3 months or so on America. Specifically, one of the major effects of the United States having lost the Second World War is the triumph of fascism over the American political system. I've heard many people talk about America being in a pre-fascist or proto-fascist state. One of the things that I discuss frequently, I read from time to time, is a passage from a book called They Thought They Were Free by Michael Mayer. It's a series of interviews and essays that he conducted with people that had lived through the rise of Nazism in Germany. And I read one in particular called But Then It Was Too Late, so that people can evaluate what the subjective experience of living through the rise of Hitler was like. And fascism does not come in any one fell swoop. It comes gradually. And the underlying thesis of the broadcasts that I've been doing for more than 13 years, I'm in my 14th year on the air, is that the United States is in fact going fascist. And I think the archive shows, all of them, bear witness to that and cover one aspect or another of the coming of fascism to the United States. But the real effect of the Trojan horse, the Galen organization, the real effect for the United States of having lost the Second World War is that the U.S. is plunging down the road to overt German-style fascism. The United States is basically going down the road that Germany went down, and what we're going to look at this evening is the coming of fascism to America. For those of us here in the U.S., that is, of course, the single most important outgrowth of the events and processes that I have been describing in RFA 37, and the ultimate triumph of the fascist political system over the democratic system here in the United States is the single most significant aspect of how the U.S. lost the Second World War. Now, I want to emphasize that, I want to reiterate, really, a point that I have stressed a number of different times during the course of RFA 37. The effects of the Galen organization are in no way to be seen as the operations of an isolated entity. Rather, the ways in which the Galen organization and behind that the resurrected or continued Reich have operated in the United States, the significance of it is the way that it has intersected with very powerful American political and national security forces. And indeed, the coming of fascism to America is as a direct result of the interaction of the Galen organization and the resurrected Reich behind it with dominant American political forces which were sympathetic to fascism in the first place, and many of the industrialists and financiers in this country had openly backed Hitler. They were avowedly pro-fascist, at least until Pearl Harbor. They not only backed Hitler politically, but they backed Hitler and Mussolini economically and militarily as a consequence. And by way of evaluating the coming of fascism to America, we're going to turn back to the origins of the Christian West concept. And specifically, we're going to take a look at another account of the negotiations conducted by Alan Dulles with diplomats slash intelligence agents of the Third Reich, many of whom were also members of the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I have looked at for many, many years, and which it lies at the core of the discussion of Radio Free America 37. Now, it's important to understand, and this has been a major feature of the broadcasts that I've done over these years, it's important to understand that fascism is not something which was alien to the United States. Not only, as I've said, were many of this country's top industrialists and financiers openly pro-fascist, but there were very large, very powerful fascist movements and political groups in the United States, and we're going to touch on those in a minute. Now, again, the Christian West concept, which we first looked at from the book, the account of which we first looked at from the book, The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, the Christian West concept was a Third Reich concept for surviving military defeat. And the Third Reich understood early on that it was going to be defeated militarily. The plan that was floated by some of these diplomats slash intelligence agents, many of whom were representatives or participants in the transatlantic and industrial and financial axis that I focused on, the basic concept proposed was that Hitler would be deposed, and the Hitlerless Reich would then hook up with the Western nations, the U.S., Britain, and France, in an anti-Soviet alliance with Germany as the keystone of this anti-Soviet alliance. this concept, obviously, was the seed concept for NATO, and as we've seen, the Galen Organization was installed as a cornerstone of NATO intelligence. We're going to look at another account of the negotiations conducted between Alan Dulles, who was head of the Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II Intelligence Agency,